time Matthew would be enjoying his morning cup of coffee at Big Lou's. So it was that when she arrived, she found Matthew's usual notice on the door. She let herself in, took down this notice, and substituted one saying, "Open." Then she tackled the mail, putting bills to one side, catalogues to another, and dealing with the inquiries from prospective artists seeking representation or an exhibition. These letters were placed in a folder Matthew described as the slush pile. It was a term used by publishers for unsolicited manuscripts sent in by prospective authors, and Matthew had been told about it by a publisher friend. "We get the most extraordinary things," he said. "The slush pile is never boring."
"Such as?" asked Matthew.
"Oh, endless memoirs. 2 years in the French Foreign Legion, for example. You'd be astonished to discover how many people have spent 2 years in the Legion, and then written about it."
Matthew tried to remember whether he had met anybody who'd served in the Foreign Legion. He decided he hadn't, but then it depended to a great extent, he thought, on the circles one moved in. Presumably there were circles for those who gravitated toward service in the Foreign Legion, people who had something to forget, apparently. Of course, the Legion itself must be aware that many of those who signed up would, in due course, write their memoirs. Perhaps they had a class as part of basic training in which memoir writing was taught to new recruits, along with instruction in weapons, drill, camouflage, and hand-to-hand combat. There would be a weekly lecture on some aspect of biographical writing, or on the merits of obtaining a good literary agent, or on some finer points of copy editing or grammar.
"And what else?" he asked. "You presumably don't just get memoirs of the Legion."
His friend shook his head.
"No, we do get other manuscripts. There's a regular stream of accounts of the life of Bonnie Prince Charlie. They're very common. I get about 5 a year. They all claim to have new insights, but it's frankly rather difficult to identify what these insights are."
He paused.
"The authors of those particular books all tend to have a certain look in their eye. It's difficult to describe it, but it's there all right."
Then, he said, there was fiction.
"These manuscripts are usually by people who are quite good at doing other things, but who feel for some reason that they have to write a novel. In fact, it's rare these days to find somebody who hasn't written a novel, at least in Edinburgh."
He paused and smiled at a recollection.
"You know, I went to a dinner party in Great King Street once where everybody, including the host and hostess, had written an unpublished novel. In fact, it was at that dinner party that I first heard, as an opening gambit, the question, what novels are your children writing? This is a variant on the question as to whether children play football or tennis, or are learning how to drive. Of course, the vast majority of these novels are unpublishable, some very much so. Then many of them are what used to be called obscene, and now are called simply adult. We received one of these recently that was all about a man who was kidnapped by a shipload of nuns. And these nuns were, how shall I put it, very friendly. The author suggested it might be of interest to a Catholic readership, but I think he meant it might appeal to those of Catholic tastes. That's a different department, you know."
"Do you have to read them all?" asked Matthew.
"Oh, that depends," said his friend. "There are some firms that simply throw them out with the waste paper. I think that's discourteous. Then there are others who ask for them in electronic format, so they can delete them at the push of a button. We take the view that you have to be careful. There are so many cases where publishers have rejected a manuscript only to discover, a short time later, that it has been published to great acclaim, and with great success, by somebody else. A famous Glasgow firm once turned down Enid Blyton. Frederick Forsyth's The Day of the Jackal was rejected, as was The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. I could go on."
Matthew laughed. "Please do. Hearing about the mistakes of others gives one such a warm feeling."
"All right," said his friend. "Golding's Lord of the Flies was rejected 21 times,
and no less a person than T.S. Eliot, turned down George Orwell's Animal Farm on the grounds that it wasn't convincing. He'd obviously never met a speaking pig. "So you look at everything in the slush pile?" asked Matthew. His friend looked embarrassed. "We don't always actually do what we say we should do," he said. "We're only human." Chapter 46. Distressed Oatmeal. Pat handed Matthew the slush pile after he'd hung up his lightweight summer scarf. She didn't like that scarf, but of course had never expressed her views openly. Clothes were personal in a very special sense. You might compliment another's clothes, but you should never criticize them. All she could say about his scarf, then, was this.
"That's an interesting color. What do you call it?"
She knew about his distressed oatmeal sweater and about his mitigated beige trousers, but the color of this scarf, she thought, was something altogether different. Matthew glanced at his scarf, now hanging on a peg near the office door. "Understated brown," he replied. "At least, that's what they said it was." He paused. "Do you like it?" Pat mustered her thoughts. There are many ways of avoiding questions.
"It suits you," she said.
Matthew smiled. "Do you mean I'm understated?" She made light of this.
"You? Oh, no, not at all, Matthew. You're just right."
He thanked her, as he could tell that she meant it. Pat was kind to him. Their relationship was an easy one. The relationship of people who may have been more than that to one another in the past, but who are now just old friends. "You're not so bad yourself," he said. She returned his smile.
"What a nice way to start the morning. A compliment or two before work. How nice."
"We don't pay enough compliments," observed Matthew. "We should tell people more often that we like them, or that they're doing a good job, or that they look great. It doesn't cost very much, and yet we don't seem to like doing it that often."
"Some people never do it," said Pat. "They can't bring themselves to say something complimentary to anybody else. They just can't. It sticks in their throat."
Matthew knew what she was talking about. It was something to do with envy, he thought. That most powerful emotion that is there in most of us, to an extent, but that could dominate the entire world view of some.
"Envy," he said. "That's what stops us."
He paused to remember his most envious friend, one whose face fell if anybody told him of some piece of good fortune. He found that sad, to go through life resenting what others achieved, or had, because one had not been successful oneself. What a waste of energy it was to sit there and fume, and what a loss. It was so easy to share the joy of another, and thereby experience, at no cost to oneself, some of the pleasure that the other felt. So, if you met a friend who had been invited to a party that you would dearly love to be invited to yourself, then, rather than being consumed by envy, you might bask in the pleasure of just knowing that the party in question was taking place and that your friend would be there.
"Two letters," said Pat, pointing to the file. "One from a final year student at the Art College, offering to interview us. For him to interview us, with a view to our representing him."
"Oh, dear," said Matthew. But then he thought, what if this man were the next David Hockney? And so he said, "I'll look at his work. Are there any photographs?"
"He's attached a set of photos of a series of paintings he's called The Triumphs of Mother. He says something about the pictures. They all feature his mother in a number of heroic situations. Climbing K2, crossing the finishing line of New York Marathon, meeting the Pope."
Matthew saw that Pat was grinning.
"Ah," he said, "nothing matters as long as he admires his mother, as the psychiatrist said to Oedipus." And there's a letter from an installation artist from Glasgow.
Rubbish bin, said Matthew. They moved on to a discussion of the forthcoming visit of a client who was considering the purchase of a work by Edward Atkinson Hornell, Kirkcudbright Harbour at Low Tide. Matthew didn't like the painting, but would do his best.
It would have been so much better if he had put a few Japanese girls in it, he confessed to Pat. Hornell was terrifically good at painting Japanese girls, and flowers, but I suppose neither of those occurs naturally in Kirkcudbright Harbour, even at high tide.
Pat laughed.
Don't say that to the client, she muttered.
Matthew looked towards the door. A customer was about to enter. Or was it? He stood stock still, hardly breathing, chilled within. Mrs. Patterson Cowie, his former English teacher, and the victim of that dreadful incident in the bookshop, was poised to enter the front door. She it was whom he'd knocked over in his flight from that intolerable and embarrassing situation. And now, just as he was beginning to forget the uncomfortable information that the police were looking for him in connection with that, here she was, the one person in Edinburgh he didn't want to see. She would identify him, and he would be arrested. Pat realized that something was wrong.
Are you all right?
He asked. Matthew found himself whispering.
That woman at the door, I don't want to see her.
Pat glanced towards the door.
Why not? I just don't, said Matthew. She was my English teacher.
Pat looked at him in astonishment.
And you haven't done your homework, is that it? Don't joke, hissed Matthew. I'm going to hide.
And with that, just as Mrs. Patterson Cowie opened the door, Matthew ducked under the well of his desk. The space there was large enough just to conceal him, although if Mrs. Patterson Cowie got too close to the desk, she would be sure to see him. Pat, struggling with her astonishment, stood up to greet their customer.
Do you mind if I take a look round? Asked Mrs. Patterson Cowie. Please do, said Pat, and let me know if I can do anything.
Mrs. Patterson Cowie approached a painting and peered at it closely.
Venice, she said.
Yes,
said Pat, glancing down at what she could see of Matthew.
Venice, yes.
Mrs. Patterson Cowie now moved closer to the desk.
That's a rather interesting painting over there, said Pat, pointing to a watercolour on the other side of the gallery. That's a William Gillies. May I show it to you?
Thank you, said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. I rather like Gillies. I always have.
Relieved at being able to steer her away from the desk, Pat led Mrs. Patterson Cowie over to the Gillies.
Lovely, isn't it?
Yes, said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. It certainly is. That's Temple, isn't it? I love that part of, East Lothian or Mid Lothian? I'm never sure where boundaries lie.
Mid Lothian, said Pat quickly. Or maybe East Lothian. Who knows?
Mrs. Patterson Cowie smiled.
Well, somebody will know, don't you think?
From the other side of the room there came an unexpected sound, a knocking of something against wood. Matthew must have shifted, thought Pat, and bumped a leg against the desk. Cramp, perhaps. Mrs. Patterson Cowie heard the noise too, and turned her head. Chapter 47 Dental Flossing. Pat had to think quickly, and she did. Looking at her watch, she gave a gasp.
Oh, my goodness! The time! Would you look at the time?
Mrs. Patterson Cowie glanced at her own watch.
Well, it's only 10:20.
As she spoke, she turned her head to look back in the direction of the desk under which Matthew was hiding.
Is there something...
she began. Pat interrupted her.
20 past 10. Oh, heavens, we're going to have to close immediately, right now.
Mrs. Patterson Cowie looked puzzled.
But you've only just opened. Why on earth do you have to close?
Pat looked at her reproachfully.
Operational reasons, of course,
she said, as if this should have been only too apparent.
And what does that mean?
Stock-taking, said Pat, sounding as firm as possible.
We have to close for stock-taking.
Mrs. Patterson Cowie looked even more puzzled.
Stock-taking?
Most of your stock, I would have thought, is on the walls. Why do you need to close if, Again, Pat cut her short.
Look, I'm terribly sorry, she said, but I'm going to have to ask you to leave, and I can't really discuss management issues with you. It really isn't any of your business.
It was against Pat's nature to be rude, but she felt that the only way of getting Mrs. Patterson Cowie out of the gallery was to give offence. With any luck, she would take the hint and storm out.
No need to be snippy, said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. I'm sorry, said Pat, but you really must go. Well, really,
complained Mrs. Patterson Cowie, I don't know what I've done to deserve this rudeness. I assure you, I shan't linger.
Good, said Pat, and moved towards the door to let her out.
When Mrs. Patterson Cowie had left, Pat made her way over to the desk and peered under it.
You can come out now, Matthew, she said. Hide-and-seek finished. Playtime over.
These comments were delivered with maximum sarcasm, even scorn, but this was lost on Matthew, who only seemed interested in confirming the departure of Mrs. Patterson Cowie.
Yes, she's definitely gone, said Pat. I told her that we were about to close for stock-taking. I was horribly rude to her, and I feel wretched about it.
Good, said Matthew, rubbing at his leg to relieve the cramp that had set in while he was under the desk.
That was quick thinking, Pat. I owe you. What you owe me is an explanation, said Pat. What a ridiculous performance. The least you can do now is to explain what that was all about.
Matthew sighed. It's very complicated, you know, but I suppose you're right. I suppose I do need to tell you about it.
You certainly do, said Pat. She heard you, you know. She heard you bump against the desk. I think she knew there was someone there.
You could have told her it was a poltergeist, said Matthew, grinning.
You could have said that we're plagued with poltergeists in the new town, and that she had better get out before chairs started whizzing through the air.
Pat made a dismissive gesture.
Come on, he said. Tell me.
Matthew seemed reluctant. I tell you what, he said at last. Why don't we go back to Big Lou's?
I know I've just come from there, but I only had one cup of coffee, and I can have another. We can close up here for half an hour, and I'll tell you over a cup of coffee.
Pat agreed, and as they left the gallery to cross Dundas Street, she asked Matthew again to explain his behaviour.
I'll tell you in Big Lou's, he said. Just wait.
He paused and then asked, How did you get on at the dental hygienist's?
All right, said Pat. She said I had healthy gums.
Good, said Matthew. Do you floss after every meal? Pat said she thought that was excessive.
Once a day is quite enough, she said. I floss in the night before I go to bed, and I use one of those water-pick thingies.
Matthew shook his head. You should floss after every meal. Think of all that stuff in between your teeth being there all day.
How do you know I've got stuff between my teeth?
You will have, said Matthew, if you eat.
There's nothing wrong with my gums, said Pat stubbornly. And what about you? What about your gums?
She sensed her advantage and pressed home her attack.
How often do you go to the dental hygienist?
They'd reached the other side of the road. Matthew looked away as if keen to avoid the question.
Come on, said Pat. Do you even go at all? And I bet you don't floss. Men are useless at flossing.
Matthew blushed. She could see that, and it gave her the answer.
You should go to the hygienist, Matthew, she said.
trying to avoid sounding prim, but failing. Nobody, she thought, can tell another person to go to the dental hygienist without sounding prim. Matthew defended himself. Why should I go if I clean my teeth thoroughly?
Because nobody, said Pat, can get plaque off by themselves. They need a dental hygienist with a pick. She has to pick it out. You know, to get that white stuff that she wipes off on a tissue on her work tray.
White stuff?
Yes, little white lumps of plaque, like tiny hard rocks. The hygienist picks them out with her little pick.
Matthew shivered. I don't know if I've got any of that, he said. I'm sure I don't.
Then let me look, said Pat. Let me look at your teeth, Matthew. I can tell, you know. I know what to look for between people's teeth.
Matthew increased the distance between them. I have no desire to show you my teeth in the middle of Dundas Street.
Because you're in denial, Matthew. You're in denial about dental plaque.
She looked at him pityingly.
I'm not, he said. Then show me.
He turned to her suddenly and bared his teeth.
There, he said. Satisfied?
Disgusting, she said, giving an exaggerated shudder.
The gaps between your teeth are full of stuff, Matthew. If you went to the dental hygienist, she'd need a pneumatic drill. A digger, even.
You're a dental snob, snorted Matthew. You judge people by their teeth.
So? She challenged. Teeth tell you a lot.
Matthew laughed. I can't believe we're having this conversation. They had reached the steps down to Big Lou's, and Pat led the way, descending carefully, because these were the steps down which one of Scotland's greatest poets, perhaps her greatest poet since Burns, had stumbled. And they were the steps down which Lard O'Connor, the emerging Glasgow businessman, had fallen on that fateful visit he'd paid to Edinburgh. These steps required caution. Chapter 48 You Ran Away. Big Lou welcomed them warmly.
Return custom, she said, smiling. Matthew had a cappuccino about half an hour ago, Pat. He's addicted, I suppose.
Addicted to your company, Lou, said Matthew quickly.
Och, who'd you weesht? Big Lou retorted. I'm no susceptible to flattery, Matthew. You should know that.
And as for addiction, Matthew continued, my caffeine intake is very small compared with some. He looked at Pat, who loved having a cup of coffee on her desk at all times.
Most of the time I drink decaf, said Pat defensively.
Matthew shook his head.
Except it isn't. A lot of these so-called decaffeinated coffees have quite a bit of caffeine left in them. They have to be treated with the Swiss water process, and then retreated if you want all the caffeine removed. With most decaffeinated coffee, you end up getting quite a hefty shot of caffeine whether you like it or not.
I don't care if I'm addicted, said Pat. I like coffee.
And you're entitled to like it, said Big Lou. Dinny listen to him, hen. Big Lou set about preparing their coffees. While she was busying herself with this, Pat and Matthew made their way towards a table at the back of the room. There was nobody else in the café, but if somebody did arrive, they would still be able to avoid being overheard.
So, said Pat as she sat down, tell me why I had to go through that ridiculous business with that poor woman. What's her name, by the way?
She's called Mrs. Patterson Cowie, said Matthew. She used to be a teacher at Watson's. She's retired now, as far as I know.
And you didn't like her?
Matthew shook his head.
No, quite the opposite. I always rather liked her. She was a great teacher. She made us learn screeds of poetry by heart. I can still remember quite a bit of it. Lars Porsena of Clugium, by the nine gods he swore that the great house of Tarquin should suffer wrong no more.
Do you know that one?
It's all about Horatio and how he defended the bridge over the Tiber.
Or Wee Sleekit Cower in Timorous Beastie. She liked Burns, and a guy called Cecil Day Lewis who wrote a poem called Flight to Australia about two men who flew to Australia in a useless old plane but somehow got there,
I can remember most of that, except the bit where they actually reached Australia.
He paused. And then there was D.H. Lawrence, and his poem about the snake, and feels that he's done something petty. And Ian Crichton-Smith, and Norman McCaig, and Robert Frost.
Yes, yes, said Pat, but why did you want to hide from her?
What had you done?
Not done, said Matthew forcefully. I didn't do it, Pat. Or if I did, I didn't mean to do it. It was an accident.
What was an accident? Asked Pat.
I was in a shop, said Matthew, and I stumbled, sort of, and knocked Mrs. Patterson Cowie down. I didn't mean to, but there was a big fuss, and I ran away.
Pat's expression showed her astonishment.
You ran away? Why on earth did you do that?
Matthew didn't answer, but looked down at the floor. Then after a few moments he looked up and told Pat,
You heard about the incident.
Me? About you knocking over... She trailed off. Now she realized what he was talking about.
So you were the perv in that shop, she muttered.
It was you.
I'm not a perv, said Matthew, looking down at the floor again. But you were trying to steal that 50 Shades book. That's a pretty pervy thing to do, isn't it?
Matthew began to raise his voice.
I wasn't trying to steal it, he protested. I had picked it up out of curiosity, and then I saw Mrs. Patterson Cowie, and I didn't want her to see me reading it, so I slipped it into my trousers.
Now that's pervy, said Pat, but corrected herself quickly. I'm sorry, Matthew. I know you're not a perv.
Thank you.
But you're in a serious mess, aren't you? My friend said the police were looking for you because they think you're dangerous, and all it would need would be for Mrs. Patterson Cowie to see your face and identify you.
Which she would.
I know, said Matthew, miserably. The police will never believe me.
Pat agreed.
Probably not. They'll probably think you're a perv.
He paused.
Sorry, Matthew. I didn't mean that.
But Matthew was still miserable.
I don't know what to do, he said. I really don't.
I'll think, said Pat.
There must be something, if you're innocent.
Which I am, said Matthew. I really am. You know me, Pat. I'd never go around knocking people over.
Of course you wouldn't, said Pat. She now felt sorry for Matthew, and she reached out to pat his hand gently. And at that moment, the door of Big Lou's opened, and Mrs. Patterson Cowie came in. Matthew had his back to her, but Pat was in full view. As Mrs. Patterson Cowie came in, she saw Pat and immediately recognized her from the gallery. She turned away to place an order with Big Lou.
"She's just come in," whispered Pat. "Mrs. Patterson Cow."
"Cowie," corrected Matthew.
"You mean in here?"
He did not want to turn round, but had he done so, he would have seen Mrs. Patterson Cowie, having ordered coffee, walk purposefully across the room towards them.
"Excuse me," said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. "I really feel that you were extremely rude to me over the road, and I thought—"
She stopped. She'd seen Matthew, who, feeling her eyes upon him, looked up slowly and with overt dread.
"You!"
muttered Mrs. Patterson Cowie. Matthew rose to his feet.
"Mrs. Patterson Cowie, please listen to me. I never meant to knock you over. I swear I didn't. It was an accident, and it was all because I felt ashamed. I'd picked up this book, you see, 50 Shades of Grey, and I was so embarrassed."
"Oh, that," said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. "Did you read it all the way through?"
"I did. And, you know, I really didn't enjoy it at all. Not the finest prose in the world, and, frankly, somewhat far-fetched. I could have made a better job of it, you know."
Chapter 49 Shafts of Light. Domenica had reached a decision. The previous few weeks had been a strange time for her, she had felt restless. This was unusual for her, as she was normally quite content to allow her life to follow its accustomed patterns, which were quiet and predictable, rather like a river that knows that it is going to reach the sea eventually and is in no particular hurry to get there. Such a river has no need to prove itself by suddenly erupting into rapids or playing for effect by becoming a waterfall. Such a river, and such a life, is satisfied with its own course, wants to be nothing else, and is, by and large, happy with its topographical fate. But then there had come a period in which she began to wonder whether the life she'd created for herself, particularly her marriage to Angus, was just too settled, too devoid of excitement. She began to entertain a vague feeling that she should be doing something more, that rather than being content with the company of Angus, she should be seeking new people, encouraging new friendships, and, most unsettlingly of all, finding more passion in her life. It was a seditious, almost frightening thought, and it was one that married people most dreaded. Given oxygen, it could transform happiness and acceptance into misery, despair, and ultimately into disaster. And that realization came to Domenica one morning in Scotland Street itself. Not in the flat, not inside, but in the street itself. It was a curious moment of enlightenment, and it came to her as she was walking back along Royal Crescent, past the old marshalling yards, and found herself standing at the bottom of Scotland Street, looking up the urban brae towards the trees of Drummond Place Gardens. It was one of those Scottish summer mornings when it was not clear which way the weather would jump. The air was still and the sky unthreatening, but there had been a slight fall of rain half an hour before, and the street sets were still glistening. Domenica had been out early, it was still only 7:30, to buy a pint of milk, and had slowly been walking back to the flat. She'd been enjoying the freshness of the morning and the relative quiet. The city, it seemed, had yet to stir. Sometimes, she'd noticed, it failed to stir at all. Not all cities feel they have to get up every day, and this, she thought, might be one of those days. But then there drifted over from Dundas Street the resigned hum of a 23 bus making its way up the hill, and she realized that people were beginning to go to work. This, she decided, would be a Tuesday like any other Tuesday. And yet, in a sudden moment of insight, she realized it wasn't. At least it wasn't for her. The thought came to her with great clarity. What she had was infinitely precious. She didn't have to do anything to make her life more exciting. She didn't have to change any aspect of how she lived. And most importantly, she had no reason to be dissatisfied with Angus. This realization struck her with an almost physical force as she stood at the bottom of the street. I am immensely fortunate. I am alive in this vast cosmos of swirling planets, so many of them sterile and dead, baking or swathed in clouds of methane or whatever it is they are swathed in. I am alive in a dear green place, and there is somebody who actually loves me. The words, dear green place, came to her unbidden. They were almost an act of cultural or geographical appropriation, as they have been used most often to describe Glasgow rather than Edinburgh. But they were the right words, exactly the right words, to describe this world. For all its problems, it was dear. For all its wars and hatreds and poisons, it was dear because we loved it and didn't want to lose it. Most of us didn't want to die. Most of us wanted to wake up each morning and find we were still here. Most of us didn't want to say goodbye to the friends we had and the places we went and things we did. Most of us wanted the place we lived in to carry on being the place it had always been. Most of us wanted to live under the modest standards of love and acceptance rather than under the strident banners of dislike and rejection. As she stood there, looking to any who might have seen her, like one who was undecided as to whether to walk any further or to turn back the way she'd come, she raised her head and saw shafts of light descending on Scotland Street. They weren't part of any heavenly manifestation, not the shafts of light depicted in those paintings where the skies open to reveal choirs of angels and cavorting, gravity-defying putti. These were ordinary shafts of light of the sort that might fall anywhere and at any time of the day, but that were somehow this morning unusual and unexpected, and in Domenica's viewpoint, overwhelmingly significant. She closed her eyes briefly. She felt heady at the moment of mystical insight that she'd experienced, but now was sober once more and needed to get back to the flat. Once there, she opened the milk, pouring a dash into the two blue-spode teacups lined up on the kitchen table, and switched on the kettle. He stared at the two teacups and smiled. They were just two ordinary blue-spode teacups, but they meant so much. They represented domesticity. They represented companionship and the compromises of marriage. One teacup was hers, and one belonged to Angus. Angus's teacup had a chip on the rim. Hers did not. Now she had to see him. He was still in bed, and Cyril hadn't yet stirred from the blanket on which he slept on the kitchen floor. She poured the tea, making sure that his was of just the strength that he preferred. These things were so important. They were everything. She went through to the bedroom. Angus was awake now and was reading a book. "I brought you your tea," said Domenica. It was what she always said, and he said in reply what he always said, which was, "Thank you, Domenica." She placed the cup on his bedside table, and he said again, "Thank you." "No," he said, "I'm the one who must thank you." And then she leaned forward and kissed him on the forehead. And Angus, although surprised, understood that this was a kiss of peace. Chapter 50. Cyril thinks. Over breakfast, Domenica said little about the mystical experience she'd been vouchsafed at the foot of Scotland Street. Moments of mystical insight are difficult enough for the recipient to understand, let alone explain to others. She'd started to speak to Angus about it, but had not found the words, and had ended up making a bland remark about the light in Scotland Street at that time of the morning being particularly... the right adjective failed to come to mind. Illuminating? No, all light was illuminating. Revealing? Again, no. Revealing light surely discourages rather than encourages that particular sort of insight. "Tight," suggested Angus. "At this time of year, light in Scotland can be tight in the morning, and then in the afternoon it gets, well, a bit more elastic." Domenica sighed. She knew that she would be unable to convey the feeling she'd experienced. Angus, however, was an artist and was interested in light. "Have you noticed," he began, "the difference between the light in the east of Scotland and the light in the west?" Domenica would have preferred to talk about her mystical experience, but Foot de Mere would settle for light. "I suppose I have. It's softer over there," she said. "Bluer, perhaps." Angus reached for a slice of toast. "Yes, I think of it as gentler. We have this very clear light here in the east, sharp, but—" he began to butter his toast—"but it's different again from the sort of light you get in Greece or Australia. It's less powerful." Domenica looked out of the window. The sun was on the roofs on the other side of the street, yellow on the grey of the slates. Beyond that, the sky, a dash of low cumulus lonely against the blue. "Do you know the reason?" asked Angus.
"What reason?"
"Why, over in the West, in Argyll and places like that, they have this soft rather than blue light. Or is it white? Sometimes I think it's white. The sort of white you see in a veil of rain, glowing a bit, in a white sort of way."
He shook her head.
"It's because of water in the air," said Angus. "I never knew that, you know, until I read about the light you see in 17th-century Dutch paintings. Think Vermeer."
He thought Vermeer. "The woman reading a letter by the window?"
"Yes, that one. Think of the light in that painting. In all of his paintings, in fact. And so many of those Dutch paintings, they're full of light. They're all about light, really. Light and courtyards and jugs and carpets. And everything they had. The Dutch were painting an inventory of their trading success, I suppose."
"And?"
Angus took a bite of his toast. "Marmite," he said, and closed his eyes briefly in appreciation. "Yes, apparently the reason why Dutch paintings are full of light..."
"Rembrandt isn't," said Domenica.
Angus considered this. "I see what you mean," he said.
"They're all gloomy, as if painted in the dark. All those browns. Rembrandt used a lot of brown, didn't he?"
"I wasn't really thinking about Rembrandt," said Angus. "Yet there is light in Rembrandt. It's there, all right. It finds the faces of his subjects and shines upon them. It's very dim light, though, just enough to create that lovely effect, as if the artist is shining a rather weak torch on the people in his paintings. There isn't enough light for anything but the face and some of the clothing. That's all." He paused. "But those other paintings, the landscapes or the illuminated interiors, there's a reason why they seem to have such light."
"And that reason is?"
"As I said, droplets of water in the air. The Netherlands is very watery. All those canals and the sea all about you has an effect on the air. There were droplets of water, and sunlight was refracted by this water, and that's why the light was as it was, and probably still is."
"And the same applies in the West?"
"Yes. Go to a place like Skye and look at the light. It's that lovely soft blue, misty, watery. And you'll find the same difference between the light in the east of Canada and the light in the west. Vancouver is all blue and soft. Newfoundland and Quebec are all bright and clear. It's to do with geography and the effect of geography on humidity."
Angus finished his toast.
"I need to get to the studio," he said. "Masita's coming at 10.
She wanted to say more to him. She wanted to say to him that he could talk to her about light whenever he chose to do so, for as long as he wanted. She wanted to say to him that she loved him, not only for what he had to say about light, but for the way he buttered his toast, for the way he liked Marmite, for the way he spoke to Cyril. She loved him for everything, and she loved the flat they lived in, she loved the kitchen and its contents. She loved the marks on the wall that needed painting. She loved the creaking floorboards. And until then, until that moment in Scotland Street, she hadn't realized how precious all this was and how strangely indifferent she had been to it all. She would never again make that mistake.
Angus left for his studio. She gave him a kiss before he went out of the door. Cyril watched from his corner, his nose twitching. Angus was his, and he felt a pang of jealousy and resentment when Domenica behaved as if Angus belonged to her. He could not, because he belonged to Cyril. One of these days, he thought, "I'll nip her ankles. Not now. Not yet." There was a time and place for everything, and the time wasn't right for that. and besides, he half liked Domenica. If one had to have somebody else in the flat, then there were many who would be far worse than this woman. That woman downstairs, for example, the woman with the boy. The boy was nice. He smelled nice. But that woman was another matter altogether. He had bitten her once before, and it had been very satisfying. But now, what was there to do but lie there and think, in so far as I can think, given what I am? A dog. That, as they say, is the bottom line. I'm just a dog. And that is a profoundly sad thing to be. Chapter 51 Catching Up. The day ahead promised to be busy. Domenica had correspondence to deal with, and after that she'd arranged to meet her old friend Dilly Emsley for coffee at Glass and Thompson on Dundas Street. That would take her until 12, when she would return to Scotland Street to prepare light lunch for Creative Scotland's visiting delegation of pygmies from the forests of Rwanda. Domenica had hoped that Angus would help her to entertain these visitors, but he had asked to be excused on the grounds that his time with his sitter was limited, and he needed to make as much progress with the portrait as possible. Dilly, however, had offered to stand in. "I'll help you rustle up something," he said, and then, after a short pause, had inquired what the guests would like to eat. "I'm not sure," replied Domenica. "I took advantage of being at Valvona and Crawler the other day and asked the young man at the counter whether he had any ideas, but he didn't. He thought pasta might be a good option as long as I didn't serve too piquant a sauce."
"Do you think they might be vegetarian?" asked Dilly.
"Highly unlikely," replied Domenica. "Traditionally they're hunter-gatherers, and as a general rule the hunting bit of that precludes vegetarianism. I've decided to go for mushroom risotto, with a side salad with bits of chicken in it. If they're vegetarian, they can leave the chicken, but I don't think they will be." She met Dilly at Glass and Thompson just before 11. They saw one another fairly frequently, but even with regular meetings, there still seemed to be a lot to be caught up on. There were the doings of mutual friends, innocent and unremarkable, for the most part, but with the occasional frisson of excitement. There was news of Scotland Street, and there, of course, Domenica had a substantial report to make.
"Irene Pollock," Domenica began.
There was a sharp intake of breath from Dilly.
"Yes," continued Domenica, "that's what most of us feel."
"An impossible woman," said Dilly, "that poor little boy of hers."
"Little boys," corrected Domenica. "Plural. She has the two. Bertie, whose goodness on wheels, and wee Ulysses, who apparently throws up whenever he sees his mother. There are the two of them now."
Dilly vaguely remembered a story about Ulysses being lost.
"Didn't she...
lose him?" interjected Domenica. "Yes. She left him in his pram outside Valvona and Crawler, and he was carted off to the council emergency nursery. She had to go and retrieve him from the social workers, and you can imagine what that was like. Social workers can be very disapproving of anybody."
"As can the government," observed Dilly.
"Ah, yes," said Domenica. "The named person legislation. Can you believe it? Can you believe that they're insisting that every child in Scotland should have a sort of official guardian? Because that's what it amounts to. Can you conceive of a better way of insulting parents?"
"I suppose they mean well," said Dilly.
"Well, anyway," continued Domenica, "they went to collect little Ulysses from the nursery, and she was given a lecture by the social workers. She didn't take that too well, I gather. And when they got back to the flat, they found they had the wrong baby. They'd been given a girl instead. Further panic."
"What a discovery," said Dilly.
"Yes, indeed. And now Irene has announced that she's going off to Aberdeen to do a PhD under the supervision of Dr. Hugo Fairbairn. He was the psychotherapist who was inflicted on poor little Bertie for years and years."
Dilly thought of something.
"Named psychotherapists," she mused. "Do you think the Scottish Government will move on to insisting that we all have named psychotherapists allocated to us, just in case?"
"Don't joke about it," warned Domenica, semi-seriously.
"Aberdeen," mused Dilly. "Is she going to live up there?"
"Apparently so." There was a silence. Then Dilly asked,
"And the boys?"
Domenica raised an eyebrow. "They're staying with the father, with Stuart. His mother, whom I know and like, by the way, is renting a flat around the corner. She's agreed to come and look after the children while Irene is off in Aberdeen with that Fairbairn character." Domenica lowered her voice. "Who is, according to Angus, her lover. He says it's the talk of the Cumberland Bar."
"Well,"
exclaimed Dilly. "And there's more news from Scotland Street," said Domenica. "Remember Antonia Colley, my former neighbour?"
"The one whose flat you bought and incorporated into yours?"
"Yes," said Domenica. "She came to Italy with us, you may recall, and went down with Stendhal syndrome in the Uffizi Gallery. Honestly, you should have seen her. Apparently, Stendhal syndrome occurs when you're exposed to too much great art. She was positively foaming at the mouth and had to be carted off to hospital. She was discharged into the care of a community of nuns, and she eventually joined them as a sort of lay sister. Not a fully blown nun, more a plainclothes version." Dilly remembered meeting a nun at a dinner party in Heriot Row.
"Didn't one of them end up coming to Scotland? One of the Italian nuns?"
"Exactly," said Domenica. "That was Sister Maria Fiore de Fiori di Montagna. She turned up in Scotland Street and decided that she liked Scotland. She stayed. She became quite the social success. All the best parties and so on."
"She was rather good at aphorisms, wasn't she?" asked Dilly.
"Oh, terrific," replied Domenica. "She had an aphorism for every occasion. Shatteringly trite, of course, but people loved them."
"We hear so few these days," said Dilly. "People seem inhibited about coining aphorisms."
"Not her. Not Sister Maria Fiore de Fiori di Montagna." "Well, anyway, Antonia's come back," Domenica continued. "She's bought a small flat in Dundonald Street, and she's already taken up residence. With Sister Maria Fiore de Fiori di Montagna."
"Is she still working on her Lives of the Scottish Saints?"
"I believe so, though apparently she's taking an interest in levitation now. She's interested in saints who were reported to levitate. Saint Joseph of Coppetino, for instance, who travelled quite long distances, apparently, horizontally. Rather more interesting than our Scottish saints."
"Who were more down to earth?" said Dilly.
"Ha!" said Domenica. "But anyway, that's the news from Scotland Street." She looked at her watch. "We must be back there by 12, she said. "The Creative Scotland people are coming at 12:30, and we must be ready."
"What will we talk about?" asked Dilly.
"Oh, I'm sure there'll be all sorts of things to discuss. I've lived with hunter-gatherers before, you know, and they tend to be utterly charming people with lots to say." After further conversation, they finished their coffee, paid the bill, and then strolled back to Scotland Street for the much-anticipated cultural exchange with their unusual visitors. Chapter 52. A Perfect Boy. On the day of the resolution of what Matthew came to call, with good-natured self-mockery, L'Affaire Patterson Cowie, the new au pair boy was due to start at 9 Mile Burn. The business with Mrs. Patterson Cowie had been traumatic, but had eventually been settled over a cup of coffee in Big Lou's, once Matthew had apologized to the retired teacher. His apology had been graciously accepted, and Mrs. Patterson Cowie had then telephoned Gayfield Square Police Station to be put through automatically to a police call centre on the island of Barra. Speaking to a recording device,
she'd explained that the search for the young man who had knocked her over in the bookshop could now be called off.
"All a misunderstanding," she said. "I've had a perfectly good apology from him, and have discovered, incidentally, that he is a former pupil of mine, and therefore a Watsonian. That's quite enough for me."
Matthew had been immensely relieved. "It was awful being wanted by the police," he confided. "I felt so furtive in everything I did."
"It's all over," said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. "But to get back to that book, I really had no time for it, you know. I can't understand what people saw in it."
"Perhaps they saw that other people were reading it," suggested Matthew. "Perhaps that was enough. An immoral panic, perhaps."
"Possibly," said Mrs. Patterson Cowie. "But let's not dwell on such things. Tell me, Matthew, are you attending Watsonian meetings regularly? You should, you know."
Matthew promised to do his best. He would have agreed to do anything for Mrs. Patterson Cowie now, who, by her generosity and forgiveness, had taken such a weight off his shoulders. He returned early to the house at 9 Mile Burn, as he and Elspeth had agreed with the Duke of Johannesburg that he would bring his nephew around at 5 in the evening, to get settled into his new position as au pair assistant to Elspeth. They hadn't interviewed this young man, who was called James, and had taken him purely on the Duke's recommendation, so desperate was Elspeth for help. They waited in the kitchen, nervously sitting at mugs of tea.
"I hope we like him," Elspeth said, and then immediately reassured herself by adding, "Of course we will. The Duke spoke so highly of him, but I suppose one would speak highly of one's nephew."
And reassured herself again with,
"But then it would be terribly embarrassing for him if he recommended a dud. He being a sort of neighbour, and people would talk. No, no, he'll be fine. I'm sure of it."
"Just calm down," said Matthew.
"He'll be fine. He really will."
They watched as the Duke's unusual-looking car made its way up the drive, disappearing into the cover of the rhododendron bushes, before re-emerging a few moments later. Their first sight of James was when he emerged with the Duke from the back seat. They watched as the Duke straightened the young man's collar, brushed his shoulders in an avuncular fashion, and then led him towards the front door. Introductions were made in the small entrance hall. Elspeth glanced at James as the Duke introduced him, and then she glanced again. "Beautiful," she thought. And then she found herself thinking, "Too good to be true." Matthew smiled at the young man. He thought, "Honest?" And then he thought, "He's not going to stay. Why should he?"
"Would you like a cup of tea?" asked Elspeth brightly. "Then we can bring the boys in. They're in the playroom. Go and check on them, Matthew."
Matthew left Elspeth to lead the guests into the kitchen.
"Young James has just had his exam results," said the Duke. "Tell them, James."
The young man blushed.
"They were all right."
"Just all right," exclaimed the Duke. "They were stellar, James. No false modesty."
"Perhaps it's real modesty," thought Elspeth.
"Go on, James," urged the Duke. "All A's, every one of them, all starred."
James blushed a deeper red.
"Lots of people get A's," he said.
"Not in my day," said the Duke. "The highest mark I got was C."
"But, Uncle," said James, "to get a C in those days counted for something."
The Duke smiled.
"You're very tactful."
"And now," said Elspeth, "what are your plans? I mean, after here?"
Before James could answer, the door opened and Matthew returned, accompanied by the triplets.
"This is Tobermory," said Matthew, pointing to one of the boys. "No," said Elspeth, quietly. "That's Fergus. This one is Tobermory, and this is Roggenwald."
The three toddlers stared at James.
"Hello, boys," said the young man.
"They can't actually talk yet," said Matthew. "They're only 15 months.
"They're very well behaved," said Elspeth quickly. "You'll have no trouble with them."
James turned to address the Duke.
"You didn't tell me about them, Uncle," he said. There was more surprise than reproach in his voice.
The Duke brushed off the